Welcome to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCain. Our show today is part of a series on breakthrough solutions, demonstrating that seemingly impossible problems actually have solutions, and those solutions are working in the world right now. Today's show is about building a new economy. The economic crisis in 2008 and its aftermath made clear that the current economic system may work well for the top few in the short term, but it is not working for the rest of us. 5 years after the economic crisis, the top banks are wealthier than ever, while millions of people are struggling to make ends meet. Nor is the current economic system respectful of nature. We are ripping out resources and polluting nature at a rapid rate, leading to the extinction of species and the poisoning of people. But there is another way. All over the world, people are talking about and working towards a new economy that works for everyone and that respects Mother Nature. One of the leaders in this movement for a new economy is our guest today, David Corden. David Corden is the author of several books, including Agenda for a New Economy and When Corporations Rule the World. David is a leader in the movement for a new economy. He is chair of the board for Yes Magazine and a founding board member of the Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. He's earned degrees, including a PhD from Stanford University, and was a professor at Harvard Business School. David Corden, welcome to All Together Now.
Delighted to be with you, Eleanor.
Yeah, I just want to start by saying how appreciative I am of all the great work you've been doing. Thank you, thank you.
Well, thank you for that note.
In a recent blog, you referred to a Native American prophecy that says basically there are two paths before us. One is scorched and the other is green. Individuals and communities have a choice which path we walk. And a lot of what I appreciate about you is that you've devoted much of your life to creating a path to a more green, democratic future. In your book, The Agenda for a New Economy, which I love, you wrote a beautiful vision of a new economy. Could you describe for our listeners a little bit of what that vision is of a new economy?
Yeah, that's always hard to summarize without without developing something of a contrast to the economy that we have. But one way to summarize it is that we've developed an economy that basically works in opposition to nature, to the natural dynamics of Earth's biosphere, to extract resources, run them through the system, drive often massive, unnecessary, unhelpful consumption, and evaluate our performance essentially by the amount of profit that it generates for Wall Street banks and corporations and the richest people on Earth. The key to change, to the positive choice, is to recognize that we're living beings, that we inhabit a living planet, that life is fundamentally a cooperative activity, and that our long-term viability and prosperity depend on creating an economy that actually works in a balanced, healthy, mutually supportive partnership with nature. So that, that involves a fundamental rethinking of the nature of reality, of who we are, and what our place is within the larger frame of creation. Now, a part of it is recognizing that new economy, well, the old economy actually works, focuses on the values and on the principles of financial management. So all values are defined in terms of financial values, and the economy, the performance of the economy is evaluated predominantly by financial performance. Now, the new economy we're talking about needs to evaluate performance based on the health and productivity of Earth's living systems, including our human health and productivity. And that gets down to the questions of what truly make us as healthy and happy. But it also means creating economic structures that decentralize power, rooted in communities of place, and in people who recognize that their well-being ultimately depends on the health and vitality of their community, both as a social system, a human living system, but also in terms of the natural systems. So that's kind of the beginning frame that I work from. But it's a fundamental shift in worldview, and ultimately it has to translate into deep, deep structural changes in our economic institutions.
That's a fabulous summary. And I know you've done a fair amount of work about worldview, and you've talked a lot about the importance of story. Can you say what you think are kind of the key shift in that worldview, and what is the story we need to be operating from that could then lead us to the shifts deep in the structures we've created?
Yeah, that's a question that the answer has many levels to it. But the simplest summary is, well, first of all, recognizing that we humans live by our stories. The stories by which we understand the nature of reality, understand who we are, what makes us happy and prosperous, understanding the stories by which we understand the nature of wealth and how wealth is created. But again, at the most immediate level, we've basically created an economy and a whole modern society based on the idea that money and markets are sacred. And that's kind of the foundation of the belief system that our current economy is based on, and the story that is continuously repeated in our universities, in our economic courses, and in the media. So that we believe that, in terms of economic activity, the meaning, the purpose of the economy is to make money. The more money we make, the wealthier we are as individuals and a society. Now, the new story around which we need to organize is that what is sacred is the earth community of which we belong. That maintaining the health and vitality of that sacred earth community, earth as a living system inclusive of people, is what is sacred, the source of our meaning and the ultimate source of our well-being. And it's, many people are involved, fortunately, in the work of rebuilding our local food systems, of reducing waste and toxics, and of curbing corporate power, of rebuilding local financial institutions, all elements of creating the new economy. But the piece that links it all together is the story of our nature as living beings and a living earth, which then takes us into beginning to understand how nature works, how nature organizes as a cooperative enterprise with many, many trillions of individual species, living beings, all organizing together, making decisions in a way that maintain the health, vitality, dynamic, and continued resilience and evolutionary capacity of Earth's living systems. So we can then begin to think of ourselves as part of that system and organize to work with it rather than in opposition to it.
Fantastic. And you mentioned in there about the need to be curbing some corporate power. So I want to shift a little bit. I think you've laid out a great kind of philosophical framework for a new economy, new living systems. And there's so many wonderful things being done, but then they get blocked by corporate power. And we saw in 2008, despite the egregious, reckless behavior of the Wall Street corporations and financial institutions, that they almost brought the whole national and global economy to a grinding halt. And yet, here we are 5 years later, and they're all doing fine. The top 10 banks now have not only survived, but they have $1 trillion more than they did before, in part from the taxpayer bailout that we gave to them. So, mm-hmm. So when we think about this new economy that we want and the new philosophical approach and belief system that you've beautifully laid out, we bump up immediately to this challenge of corporate power. So what do you say to people who say, well, that all sounds great, but how do we deal with this enormous corporate power?
Yeah, many dimensions to that question also. To me, the answer, again, starts with challenging and changing the framing stories.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, the power of corporations, I mean, obviously, it relates to their ability to buy our politicians, the dependence of our politicians on campaign contributions, and the fact that then this gives inordinate power to those people who control great amounts of money. But the power is also based on the ability of corporations to control our media system and control the stories by which we understand the nature of the economy. So first of all, we are conditioned to believe that money is wealth, and that therefore people who are making money are creating wealth to the benefit of the whole society. So if you see what Wall Street does, and the contrast here between the Wall Street economy, which is purely about making money, versus the Main Street economy, which is about the systems and institutions through which people make their daily living. But Wall Street is dedicated to making money. Now, here's where we need to penetrate a fundamental illusion. And again, the illusion that money is wealth. It took me very many years to figure this out, but eventually realized that money is, of course, nothing but a number. And I'm not talking about here about a need to go back to the gold standard. That's also part of the illusion. But however money is created, ultimately it is just a number. In our current system, where it is, it's essentially numbers on computer hard drives and accounts that that are labeled financial assets. Now, that we've created a society in which our access, most of us, our access to the most essentials of living, food, water, medical care, education, all of these things basically depend on our access to money, because that's the way we've decided to organize society. If you have money, you have access to these things. If you don't have money, you don't. That, of course, gives huge power to those people who control the ability of society to create and allocate money. And if you understand how that system works, our money system in the United States and other countries are basically variations of this. It starts with the Federal Reserve, which is able to create any amount of money it chooses, up in the trillions of dollars, with a simple computer keystroke, making that available as credit to banks who, within the fractional reserve system, the banking system, the private banking system, is in turn able to multiply the amount of money created by the Federal Reserve, by roughly 10 times, but that calculation depends on a lot of complex variables. But anyhow, it is the Federal Reserve, in turn, is, it's presented to us as a public institution, but it is basically an institution that controlled by and devoted to serving the banks. So that whole money system has become devoted not to financing real investment in creating real jobs for real people who are engaged in creating the things that we all need to be healthy and happy in our daily lives, but rather simply to gaming the money system to create more money. And for example, following the crash, the Federal Reserve has been making money available to the banks at virtually 0% interest rates, with the assumption that somehow those banks are going to invest that money in ways that creates jobs. Now, in fact, of course, what they've been doing with it is investing in ways that pump up restore essentially the financial bubble of the stock market, which we've seen that the stock market has recovered, even though the real economy on which people depend on for their livelihoods is still in total devastation. But essentially, the Fed creates the money, feeds it into the banks. The banks then feed it into the stock market to pump up the price of stocks, which then gives them more financial collateral that they can use for more borrowing. And so this restores the assets of the richest among us while keeping unemployment high and keeping the wages, earnings, and benefits of ordinary people trying to make their living keeps those wages and benefits at rock bottom. So understanding the distortions begins with recognizing that money is just an accounting system, that you've got a few people and institutions in a position to manipulate that to their own advantage, and that through mechanisms that do absolutely nothing to create anything of real value. Now, another key here is the issue of ownership. We give a fair amount of attention to income inequality, which, of course, is extremely important. But underlying that income inequality is the extraordinary inequality in the concentration of ownership, and particularly the concentration of ownership of both financial assets and real assets in global corporations that, again, are accountable only to financial markets that value only money, and the ownership shares in those institutions, again, are highly concentrated in a small minority of the population. So within the financial markets, we organize the whole society, for the most part, around a system of an extreme form of absentee ownership, putting power in the hands of owners whose interests in the economy are defined solely by financial returns to those assets. A major part of the transition to a new economy needs to be a fundamental redistribution and restructuring of ownership so that, we move from corporations essentially owned by the financial markets to businesses that are owned by real people, either as individual owners in the community, but you can also do larger scale activities and enterprises through cooperative ownership, which is a form of real private ownership. It's not a repudiation of private ownership, but it is ownership on a cooperative basis, so that your local businesses, if they're owned cooperatively by their workers, are owned by people who live in that community, who have a stake in the health and vitality of that community, and so they have a direct interest in those businesses being managed in a way that not only produce the necessary financial return through wages as well as profits to maintain their livelihood, but these are people that also have an inherent interest in the health and vitality of both their community, their neighbor, and their local natural environment. That's what some people call a total living return, because it is our the return in terms of our living well-being, of which a financial income is only one element.
Fabulous. So I wanted to just pick up on a piece of what you said, because a lot of people don't understand this, and this is really critical to how our current economy works, and that is about the Federal Reserve. You know, a lot of people think that it's the United States government that makes the money, and that the Federal Reserve is, as you say, a public agency responsible to Congress and the president. But the fact is that that's not true. It's the Federal Reserve itself has the power to create money in the way you're talking about, and they are not accountable to Congress and the president. The president appoints the head of the Federal Reserve, but they really are not accountable to Congress or to the president for what they do. So what would you say about how would we make that change then? Do you see the Federal Reserve as something that then would become taken over by the federal government, or that the federal government takes over its own control of its own currency? Because right now, every time the federal government spends money, we're borrowing it from the Federal Reserve. Are we not, and paying interest on it?
Yes, it's a very curious arrangement, and it is part of what I would consider to be the fraud, that the Federal Reserve creates this money, channels it into the banks, when the government is, you know, creating that out of nothing, and then that money flows from the banks when the government is borrowing, ultimately to the government, but with the taxpayers paying an interest rate set by the markets at some level above what the banks are actually paying to the Federal Reserve. So there is a margin there that is pure bank profit for doing absolutely nothing other than being an intermediary between the Federal Reserve and the government. Now, there's a lot of very complex issues involved in that set of relationships, but the proposal that I find interesting, I mean, a lot of people say that we should totally eliminate the ability of the banks to create money through the fractional reserve system. Now, that needs elaboration that rarely comes up in those discussions. Basically, if the banks, the banking system that is creating that money is comprised of Wall Street banks that are creating money to further play games in the financial market, then that is a very perverse system and should be done away with. On the other hand, if you think about the financial system structured more in the way it was structured when I was growing up back in the, mid-1900s. The financial system was primarily comprised of local banks, single local banks that were locally owned and that provided credit for homeowners and businesses in the local community in response to local needs and opportunities. So if you think about that kind of a structure, the capacity of the banking system to create credit in response to real needs and opportunities is a very functional and viable arrangement, and very different from a system in which Wall Street banks are creating money simply to play financial games and to profit from being an intermediary between the Federal Reserve and the federal government. The proposal that I really like comes from William Grider, which is the idea that if the there is a need in a modern economy for an independent agency performing the functions of a central bank to decide what is the proper level of the money supply to facilitate the transactions in the economy at any particular point in time. So that institution has to have the ability to make decisions to increase or reduce the money supply. And you can imagine if that power resided with Congress, particularly given the kinds of dysfunctions of our present Congress, mm-hmm. the results would surely be disastrous, that that does have to be an independent function. But the question is, where, how is that structured in terms of who is that agency ultimately accountable to, but most particularly, if it's expanding the money supply, where does that money go? So Bill Greider's proposal is that we create a federal infrastructure bank so that that money would flow into the economy. The Fed would decide how much new money is needed. That money would flow into this national infrastructure bank in a no-recourse loan, which means it never necessarily needs to be repaid. That money would then be used by that bank to fund infrastructure projects approved by Congress, but that would be funded only as the money came available from the Federal Reserve. That money for infrastructure would then flow actually into local economies through employing workers and, you know, local purchasing of all the necessary equipment and so forth. So instead of flowing into financial markets, it would flow into local economies, and if we've restructured the financial system, broken up the big banks, restructured as local financial institutions, preferably primarily locally cooperatively owned, then that money would recirculate within the local real economy, the Main Street economy, and create real jobs and restore real economic prosperity. So at one level, it all sounds very complex. Once you break through all the complexities and begin to see the kind of simple outlines of the possible system, it's actually quite simple. But the shift begins with recognizing that money is just the accounting system, and how we manage the accounting system depends on where power is going to flow in society and determine whether whether things like economic stimulus are actually stimulating real economic activity or just playing financial games.
So that's fabulous. We're going to take a break now, and when we come back, we're going to be talking some more about what's the cutting edge in building the new economy, who's out there doing what, and how you, the listeners, can get involved in it. We're pausing now for a break. This is Eleanor LeCane speaking with my guest, David Corden. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Eleanor LeCane speaking with my guest, David Corden, author of When Corporations Rule the World, An Agenda for a New Economy. We've been talking about building a new economy, and just before the break, we said we'd talk some more about solutions and action we can take to build this new economy. So, David, a question for you. If you were president, what would be the top three things you would do to create a new economy?
Oh, there's a great question. Ah. Yeah, it's interesting. Of course, in Agenda for a New Economy, which the first edition came out just as President Obama was being inaugurated, and of course, I have a chapter in there with the address to the nation that I dreamed he might give. Been very sobering since, and of course, one thing that I realize has become so evident. That the president, in many ways, is very limited in what he can do. Certainly has huge influence, but in terms of the leadership on fundamentally shifting the way we think about the economy and changing the rules, that the real leadership from that, I realize, has to come from citizen movements. It's simply not going to come from within a political system that is totally controlled by corporate interests. On the other hand, in terms of what are the most fundamental interventions, the kind of the first one on the list is changing the indicators by which we evaluate the performance of the economy. And of course, we now evaluate that performance based on really two indicators. One is GDP, gross domestic product, which is in a sense a measure of the rate at which money is flowing through the economy, which is a really ridiculous measure because it doesn't make any difference what you're spending that money for. It could be for environmental cleanup. It could be for the costs of legal suits and divorce and incarceration, prisons, and all the things that are symptoms of our social breakdown, a social environmental breakdown. Or it may be for meeting people's real needs. But we need to shift to a system of indicators that, in my view, needs to be based predominantly on non-financial indicators. Indicators of, are people getting educated? Do they have good diets? Are they healthy? We could go on with a whole list. And the interesting thing is that many communities around the United States have developed their kind of non-official indicator systems based on citizens getting together and say, what would be the indicators of an economy that is really working the way, producing the outcomes that we really want in terms of health and well-being? Perhaps the best model in the world so far, the closest that I'm aware of, is the Bhutan happiness indicators, the Himalayan nation of Bhutan, very small country, but working from a very different perspective. Then, foundational is the money system, the restructuring, not only breaking up the big banks to assure that they're small enough to be able to fail, but really restoring a system of community financial institutions. So any move that works on breaking up the big banks, the immediate campaigns that are very active are the Move Your Money campaigns, move your money out of Wall Street banks, Bank of America, Chase, Wells Fargo, any of the big Wall Street banks, and move it into local banks or credit unions, or banks like One Pacific Coast Bank that is a very interesting kind of model, or several of them, where they're somewhat larger banks, but they're owned by nonprofit foundations that maintain a mission focus so that they are really devoted to meeting local financial needs. There's also a movement for state banks so that state financial assets are deposited in a bank owned by the state, and those assets then in turn are managed in ways that leverage the capacity to finance local businesses and local farmers, things that actually support the local economy. Then there's the whole area of law. And there's a very, very interesting, well, there's actually two parallel initiatives. One is the campaign for a constitutional amendment to strip away the supposed rights of personhood bestowed on corporations by the Supreme Court, particularly in Citizens United. So this is all leading up to a constitutional amendment. That's a very important set of initiatives. On the other side of that is the less known initiative to establish a legal framework that recognizes the rights of nature. Now, what this is really about is not, humans bestowing rights on nature, but rather humans recognizing that our ultimate existence, not just our health, but our existence depends on the health of nature. And therefore, the ultimate legal protection needs to be the protection of, the only way to frame it within our legal system is the rights of nature, the rights of nature to survive and thrive. The healthy forest system, healthy soil systems, healthy ocean systems, healthy water, healthy climate systems, all of those are foundational. And ultimately, in a sense, the rights of nature, the rights of those systems must trump even human rights. Because if those systems are not healthy, there simply are no humans. So it's a totally different hierarchy than our present hierarchy of rights that put the emphasis on property rights and, by extension, the rights of corporations. And in a sense, you can make an argument that our current legal system puts the rights of corporations ahead of all other rights, which is an act of absolute insanity. Then there are interventions to really rethink our whole system of knowledge in the academy. There's a small new organization, the New Economics Institute, that's been working with students on campuses across the country. It started out as a divestment campaign to get universities to divest their endowment funds out of fossil fuels, which is a very important initiative. But it's interesting that some of the students have picked up from that and begun to challenge the economics courses that they're taught, the whole framework of economics as a discipline, which supports all of these fallacies about money as wealth, the idea that corporations and Wall Street are creating wealth, that unregulated markets, all this nonsense around the prevailing economic ideology is taught as science in most of our university economics courses, and students are being to stand up and say that's nonsense. This is not science. This is ideology, and it is ideology totally ungrounded in either physical reality or moral reality. But then once you start to get into that, you begin to realize how the whole disciplinary structure of the academy and of the university is built around siloed disciplines, most of which are totally out of touch with reality and result in an educational system that systematically undermines our intellectual capacity to think in terms of systems and to understand how society really works and how natural systems really work. So that all needs to be restructured. Then there are initiatives around ownership, and there are many initiatives around the country and around the world moving towards systems of cooperative ownership. And one of the really interesting breakthroughs that I see is the move among some of the more progressive and deeper thinking unions in the United States around the promotion of conversion of our economy to a cooperative economy and stressing worker ownership. So instead of workers negotiating with management and the absentee owners represented by the stock market, they actually use their clout, their organization, their union funds to become the owners of those enterprises. It's a very major shift in perspective. Examples like the Madragon cooperatives in Spain demonstrate the potential for doing this on a large scale, but that whole movement is fundamentally important. And then there's the whole issue of the organizational structure of the economy, and there are so many initiatives currently focused on strengthening, rebuilding local economies, local food systems, local money systems that are all part of creating economic structures that root power in community and connect that power with the interests of the community as a social organization and also as an environmental organization or environmental systems. So that's kind of a long list. I mean, the reality here is that ultimately everything has to change. as you get into the issue of what are the framing stories that are dominant in the culture, most all of the prevailing stories need to be changed about the nature of values, about the nature of wealth, the nature of the economy, and so forth. So there, you know, there are openings on every front for citizen action, and on every one of those fronts you have extraordinary action by citizens. And the best way I know to get an overview of that, as well as to bore into the details, is actually through Yes Magazine, which I happen to be a co-founder and board chair, as you mentioned, because that is our mission, to document the stories of the people who are actually working for deep change. And our website in particular is an extraordinary wealth of information and reportage on both the framing ideas, but also the people who, at all levels, from the local to the national to the global, are working to make those ideas a reality. And it's a place to find the organizations that are doing the real work and find ways to connect with them.
Yes, I think that's a fabulous description of the where the interventions are, where we need to and can take action that will bring about some of these needed shifts. And I want to add my voice to Yes Magazine as an incredible wealth of resources, kind of looking for the emerging new world, because I'm convinced everything we need is out there, that we have the ideas and the projects and the programs and the stories that we need to create this just and sustainable and democratic world, and we just need to have more people know about them and be joining in and participating and creating with them. So I encourage all our listeners to go to the Yes Magazine website and to subscribe to that wonderful magazine.
And that is yesmagazine.org, all one word.
Excellent. I did want to ask you about a meeting you had in the not-too-distant past with Native Americans, where you met at John D. Rockefeller's estate and were meeting about what could be done about the kind of the state of the world. And you mentioned in your blogging about that you're concerned about corporations using our concern about the environment to increase their commodification of natural resources. Could you explain a little bit about what you see happening with that commodification of resources?
Yes. Yeah. The meeting that you mentioned was part of the lead up to the Rio Plus 20 international gathering in Rio de Janeiro, which was essentially a 20 year follow up to the 1992 Earth Summit meeting of heads of states and governments in Rio to carry out an environmental summit. Now, very little actually came of that original summit, and actually not much came of the follow-on summit. But in that gathering with these indigenous leaders, the thing that was so powerful to me was they were sharing with us and examining the implications of the traditional indigenous belief that nature and earth are sacred. And it's very interesting. This is not the importance of our understanding and thinking about what is sacred. And it's not a matter of praying to earth, but it is sacred in the sense of what is most foundationally important from a values perspective, but also from a well-being perspective. And indigenous peoples on the whole have tended to recognize for a long time the essential nature and importance of our relationship to earth and to nature. And they've begun to speak out in relation to these international gatherings like Rio Plus 20 to say we need a whole new frame. We need to look at nature as a that which is most sacred to our lives. Now, this brought out the juxtaposition with the corporate interests that were going into Rio with proposals of saying, wow, yes, Nature is really important. And it is so important that we have to value nature by putting a price on her, which means making her available essentially at auction to the highest bidder, to the people who control the most money. But that, of course, is not part of the corporate story. But rather the corporations put forward the idea, if we put a price on, then that will be the key to saving nature. But, of course, what's really behind that is the idea of, okay, we got a price on nature, we can further commodify nature, we can then further concentrate the control and ownership of nature to extract natural resources for short-term financial benefit. And in fact, if we can securitize nature, turn these assets into tradable securities, then we can do to nature what we did to the housing market and housing mortgages, because we can then begin to create all these fancy derivative products. We can trade them in all these weird exchanges, pumping up the values, creating financial collateral, doing more borrowing to further pump up those values, play games with our computerized trading, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. We can make huge amounts of money. And of course, in the process of that, we will further accelerate the destruction of nature. So what the indigenous people have been bringing forward is a foundational idea that a number of environmental groups have been picking up on, that no, this is not about putting our mother up for sale, putting a price on her. This is about recognizing that Mother Earth is sacred and must be protected at all costs as we would protect our mother. And it is foundational to a fundamental paradigm shift in how we think about our relationship to nature. And, of course, that begins to provide the conceptual foundation for this movement to recognize the rights of nature within a legal framework that places the health of nature beyond the reach of corporations, and raises actually some very, very interesting questions about how we think about property rights, which, again, is one of the foundational conversations that we absolutely have to have as a species.
Right, and did I read somewhere the other day that actually the country of Ecuador has put the rights of nature into their constitution?
Yes, that is absolutely right. And there's a very interesting international organization, the Pachamama Alliance, that is among the groups that are encouraging putting that in countries to put that into their constitutions. But also, there are moves around the United States at the local level, local initiatives at city, county, I'm not sure about state level, but efforts to pass resolutions recognizing the rights of nature, which of course probably don't have huge actual legal impact at the moment, but they're very powerful educational devices to move forward the conversation, and they're under actually a direct counterpart to the move to amend initiatives, the movements to amend our U.S. Constitution to strip away this absurdity that corporations have the rights of humans.
Great. Well, you mentioned the Pachamama Alliance and, of course, Yes Magazine. Are there some other organizations out there that our listeners should know about that they could maybe get involved in or learn more about?
Oh, my. There are so many that the only realistic thing I can do is say go to the Yes Magazine website and start your research there.
Yeah,
I mean, you may be familiar with Paul Hawkins' work on the global movements and documenting literally millions of organizations around the world that in one way or another are engaged in this process. And so any effort to point out one or two and say these are the these are the ones you should go to misses a much much bigger and very important point that that these initiatives are pervasive. Now, of course, one of the one of the things that we need to deal with is, particularly in progressive movements, we tend to be very fragmented. And at one level, this makes perfect sense because we have to have action on all of these different fronts. The important thing is that we recognize the larger underlying story that connects these initiatives so that we don't think about them as competitive or say, you know, if you're not working on my initiative, you're not working on the most important thing. That there are many important things. All these initiatives are important, and we need to have the capacity to engage in all sorts of alliances and coalitions and so forth that are likely to be constantly evolving, but recognizing at the deeper level we're all working on the same thing.
Exactly. And I love in your Agenda for a New Economy where you talk about the parallel between the years leading up to the American Revolution when people had a lot of concerns about how things were being run in the American colonies, concerns about the control of the British monarchy, and there was a lot of discussion, debate, dialogue, and it looked that moment virtually impossible that this ragtag group of farmers in what was then the colonies could actually take on the British Empire, which at that point was the most powerful army in the world. And yet the American revolutionaries did take it on and, in spite of all odds, actually shifted it and created our great nation. So, you know, sometimes there can be, you know, it looks like formidable opposition, absolutely impossible to change, whether it's the British Empire back during the American Revolution or the Soviet Union or the apartheid in South Africa, and yet all of those, you know, giant entities did shift dramatically here in our lifetime. So that's a very inspirational story.
David, yeah, I love that story, and I'm so glad you brought it up because it is so relevant to our current moment.
Yeah, exactly. So how can listeners learn more about your work?
Well, on the YES website, I have my own website, livingeconomiesforum.org, where I've had the basic outlines of my work and post links to my most current ideas. And then if you go to the YES website, I have, and look under blogs, I have an occasional blog post on the YES website. On the Living Economies Forum website, you can also sign up for an occasional newsletter, and we send out notices from time to time as I've posted new things.
Fantastic, and I would encourage our listeners to read your books, including the Agenda for a New Economy. And do you have a favorite book that you would encourage folks to read?
Well, of all my books, my favorite actually is The Great Turning, from Empire to Earth Community, because it puts all these issues in the broadest sweep of creation and the human experience. On the other hand, the Agenda for New Economy is the most recent, and it does provide probably the most comprehensive overview of my thinking as of a couple of years ago. I'm just starting to think about a next book, which will pull together pretty much what we've been talking about today and the kind of outline we've been discussing it. So.
Fantastic. Well, that's all the time we have for today. And David Corton, thank you so much for coming on the program. You're you're a visionary, a philosopher, and a fabulous human being. So thank you.
Well, thank you, and thank you for the work that you're doing to get these stories of possibility out to a much larger public.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you want to learn more about Breakthrough Solutions, you can go to www.thebreakthroughway.com. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Next week, my co-host Charlene Spretnik will be here with her guest. I'll be back 2 weeks from today. Thanks for joining us. This is Eleanor LaCane with All Together Now.